Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmaker Show. So today we have a very exciting guest, you know, a guest that it's really building something incredible, you know, in India. And again, going through the story of building, scaling, financing, you know, in this case, you know, there's like a very interesting approach where there's a play here of equity and then also special purpose vehicles, SPVs. We're going to be learning about how he left his job as an investment banker overnight. Basically, you know, like what happened, you know, with a breakdown that they had, you know, in the business and how they used that, you know, ultimately to inspire, you know, and to really build the fundamental building blocks of the business. Also why, you know, and how they brought a private equity firm to really help them, you know, in the journey. And many other stuff, like for example, COVID, how it affected them. But again, we are going to be having a very inspiring discussion today. And without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Diman Shah. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Alejandro. Thank you. Pleasure to be on.
So originally born in India. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up over there?
It's amazing. India is an exceptional place. I grew up in Bombay in India. Bombay is, you know, one of the biggest, not one of, it is the biggest city in India. So, you know, bustling. It's a huge cosmopolitan city. A lot going on. So you get a lot of exposure very early on in life, right? You're exposed to finance, you're exposed to business, you're exposed to art, you're exposed to culture. You have people from all over the world coming in and out. So really, really just a fabulous experience growing up in Bombay and growing up in India in general. Very, very exciting place to be. And it always was right through the 90s.
So then walk us through how, you know, it was, you know, that change from being in India all of a sudden to finding yourself in Chicago, you know? I mean, that's quite the shift.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, like I said, grew up in Bombay and wanted to study abroad and do my undergraduate abroad. Quite common in India for, you know, students to go abroad to study. So went to Northwestern University in Chicago for my undergraduate. I studied economics and from there moved on, moved to New York. I graduated in 08, actually, which is a fun year, and moved on to New York, where I worked as an investment banker with HSBC for a few years. Very interesting time, obviously, to be a banker, and especially as an analyst, it was a very, very exciting time. So I was in New York from, you know, 08 till 11. And then, you know, resigned and moved back to India because I was always clear that I wanted to do two things. One was start my own business. I didn't know what it would be in. And the second was do it back in India. You know, the country has so much potential and the journey is so early here that, you know, I wanted to be one of the first to ride the wave. So moved back to India and started the business.
So then let's talk about this specifically because, you know, you resigned. I mean, you were an investment banker, you know, in New York City. You were doing pretty well because investment bankers do very well in New York City. And then all of a sudden, you know, you decide to resign, you know, almost overnight, you know, and leave that behind. So what triggered that?
You know, I think two things. Well, three things, right? I think number one was this desire always actually for several years, even through high school, to be an entrepreneur. I loved it. I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I didn't know, right, in high school what I would be or what I would do, but I knew I wanted to do something of my own. So I think that was trigger number one that was always, you know, playing in the back of my mind. Trigger number two was that India is such an exciting place. And back then, you know, it's now in 2023 and 2024, people are talking about India on the world stage and the global stage, right? As an economic powerhouse. And we've always been known as the largest democracy. And we've had a lot of good things going for us. But we were never really considered a real economic powerhouse. It's only now that we're known as that. And back then, I you know, growing up in India, I knew the potential that we had, right? We have a highly aspirational kind of population. People want to do better and get ahead in life. Point two, we have a very young population. So I knew the opportunities would only get bigger and more vibrant. And I knew that if you combine the two of this, right, this aspiration and the size of the population, it would be a really strong consumer story. So I think the lure of moving back to India for all of these macro factors was just a lot for me. And thirdly, of course, you know, my family was here. And at the end of the day, you know, I kind of wanted to be around them and not two continents away, you know, and literally on the other side of the world. So that was, I think, the third draw to come back.
And when you came back, you know, there was a trip that you did to Goa that changed everything. What happened during that holiday trip?
Yeah, so took a short holiday, right, and moved to Goa. I went to Goa on holiday, and I had grown up going to Goa. Actually, Goa is very close to Bombay. It's about like a 40-45 minute flight from Bombay. So just wanted a quick break. Went to Goa. It was my brother and I, and we fell back in love with Goa. Right, we had grown up going to Goa, but then you know I'd been away for 7 years or 8 years, and hadn't really gone to Goa in maybe a decade by that point. It was then that I just fell back in love with Goa, right? And everything to do with Goa. And I said, look, let's buy a small place for ourselves here. And we looked around and there was just nothing, nothing that I would want to buy or, you know, have as a home. And that's when we realized, hey, why don't we build a truly a world-class product for people like us in Goa, right? Getting into real estate in the cities, Alejandro, in India, is really difficult, right? Real estate is very expensive. Land is very expensive. There are too many hoops to kind of jump through in India. So we thought Goa kind of checks all the boxes for us. It, you know, the capital commitments, etc., won't be ludicrous to start in Goa. We convinced our father to mortgage his home in Bombay, got a loan on his home, bought a plot of land in Goa, put our savings into it as well, bought a plot of land in Goa and built our first home. We sold it at the time for just shy of $2 million, which by the way, just to give you context, at the time in Goa, the average selling price for a home was about $250,000, and here we come and list a home at $2 million and sell it at 1.9 or 1.8 or whatever it was, very close to 2 million, right? And people thought we were crazy, right? They were like, who's going to buy a $2 million home in Goa? Right? It's not a primary city. Where are you guys coming from? And I think for us, we were very clear that we have to build. If we build a world-class product, layer on a world-class service, so each and every one of our properties are fully furnished, down to it's not just flooring and paint on the walls, it's furniture, it's white goods, it's accessories, it's down to, I mean, we even have the Nespresso pods for an Nespresso machine supplied to you by us, right? So it's literally, you just bring your clothes, we bring everything else. The market hadn't seen something like this in India. I like to think we build some of the most beautiful homes in the world. And, these were really, I mean, we blew people's minds, right, when we hit the market with this product and this service. And we always viewed ourselves as a luxury brand, not as a real estate brand. And we did everything that a luxury brand would do. And I think people loved it, right? The person who bought our first home has since recommended, you know, at least 35 to 40 new customers for us, who have actually become customers. I mean, he's introduced us to many more. So it's been, I think we just came to the market with such a different product and service that it really hit the mark at the right time.
So I guess for the people that are listening to really get it, what ended up being the business model of the company? How do you guys make money?
Sure. So we buy a plot of land. We buy it in, we set up SPVs. So these are special purpose vehicles in which we buy specific plots of land. Each SPV is a project. We can build anything from one home to 15 homes on in that SPV, depending on the size of the plot of land. Now, again, you know, like I mentioned earlier, we started when we were kids, right? We were in our 20s when we started. So we were always short on capital in the early days. So unlike any other real estate brand, we couldn't put our own capital to buy land and land bank and sit on these massive land banks on which we could unlock value. We could only buy land enough for that one project. So what we did is we decided we won't use our balance sheet to buy the land. We'll use our balance sheet to construct and sell. And we've started working with, you know, professional investors, large family offices, you know, smaller financial institutions who kind of became partners. And we would identify the parcel of land. We would diligence the parcel of land. We would put it into an SPV. These investors would come and fund the SPV. This SPV would then do a JDA, which is a joint development agreement, with us. And we would work on a revenue share model, you know, and give a return to the SPV holder while we would take a certain percentage of the profit. And that's how we've grown. So very capital efficient, you know, and we still retain that model even at this stage. Because, you know, it's just a capital efficient de-risk model, and it enables us to focus on execution and quality rather than get lured by, you know, the romanticism of land banking, which a lot of real estate people fall into. So to us, land is the equivalent of steel, bricks and stones. It comes in, it goes out. That's how we view the entire business.
So I know that the 2 years in the making here, you know, there was something that happened with the roof, you know, of one of the first homes. So how did that, you know, breakdown event, you know, ended up becoming a breakthrough for you all?
Yeah, you know, I think that was one of our first kind of, and especially for us, it was a big learning, right? So 2 years into, you know, us starting, We now realized, hey, look, we're onto something, and this is building nicely. And then we get a call from the person who bought our first ever home, and he's like, look, guys, I have so Goa, like Bombay, gets a very heavy monsoon for 4 months in a year, 3 to 4 months in the year, right? Which is the summer months in say New York, right? But June to kind of August, September period. And he calls us and saying, hey, I have a pretty bad leak in the roof above my kitchen. And look, the warranty period that you've given me is over, right? We had given a 1-year warranty to him on anything structural. But look, guys, this is like, it's not like I've done something or I haven't maintained the home for this leak to happen, right? This is obviously, there must be some issue with your structural, the structural work that you guys did. So we are now in the situation where we're still in the early days, right? We don't have all this extra capital floating around. Replacing a roof of, you know, 25% of someone's home is not cheap, especially not in those days. So that's one thing. The other side of things is we're legally not compelled to do anything, right? It's not our problem. We're kind of out of the warranty period. And by then we had raised some equity in the whole co as well, from, you know, a very large family office of a big industrialist in India. We actually happened to be meeting him that day, just to kind of give him an update on, you know, where the business was. So we kind of brought this up saying, you know, how do you think we should handle this? And we got what possibly the best piece of advice, which we live by till today, which is take a loan, do whatever you have to, but fix that roof at your dime, right? Because the brand, if you're here to build an institution for the long run, and if you want to build a brand that's going to go way past you guys, you need to invest in that, and you need to fix it. Forget what the paperwork says, forget the legalese. You morally need to fix this for the sake of your brand. And that's what we did, actually. We took a loan again, fixed this gentleman's roof. And, you know, this gentleman has actually resulted in over $15 million in sales since then, just through his referrals, right? And it was a very real experience, very early in our lives, in our business lives. And I think it was a great learning, great advice, and I guess shows the value of even having good advisors and good partners with you early on, right? And it was a real pivotal moment for us.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on, when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of a cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
Obviously, you know, as you guys continue with the business, you know, COVID, you know, hit as well. And I guess with COVID, how did it affect the business, and how did you guys go out navigating that particularly, you know, tough time, I guess, for the whole world?
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, if I think of COVID, I break it up into three kind of, you know, three phases, right? The first phase was the phase I think everybody went through, which was the panic phase and the unknown, the absolute unknown, right? So in India, this was March 2020. I think it started hitting Europe and the US slightly earlier, towards the end of 2019. But India got hit really badly. I'll always remember it was the middle of March 2020, so nearly 4 years ago. And there was a period of 2 to 3 months where everything just stopped, right? Clients stopped calling. Clients who had already committed to buying homes were now kind of, you know, getting a little antsy and wondering whether they should go through with the purchase, et cetera, et cetera. So there was a state of panic. And, you know, I think what was really helpful was, you know, I graduated in 2008. And I became an investment banker in September 2008, where there was, you know, the biggest of black swan events, I think, in our decade, or I mean, in several decades, where it happened right about then. And funnily, we had a really good next 3 years. I mean, I then resigned in 3 years, so it carried on. But for the next 3 years, business was actually really good as a banker. You know, that's when I realized, hey, look, I think we might need to be in the trenches for a few months, but my sense is this might actually be really, really good for the business, right? People are going to want more space. People are going to want to move out of the cities because you were just, you know, with a child and with a family, you feel cramped. We had very stringent lockdowns here in India, and they went on for about 18 months finally. At that point, we didn't know how long it would go on, but it went on for 18, 24 months, really strict lockdowns. And suddenly, sure enough, 3 months after that first, you know, March till, say, May, June, suddenly the phones didn't stop ringing, right? Clients were calling, potential clients saying, hey, look, I'd love to, you know, we operate in Goa. We operate in a place called Alibag, which is, you know, the Hamptons of Mumbai. It's a 30-minute boat ride. It's a two-hour car journey from Bombay. So the rich set of Bombay love Alibag. Goa is a completely national market. So Bombay, Delhi, Hyderabad, you know, people from Singapore, Hong Kong, everybody loves Goa. So suddenly, 3 months later, right, the phones just didn't stop ringing. And we started having really, really strong kind of growth. And I think that was that second phase of COVID, right, which for a period of 24 months, I mean, you know, things just went through the roof, right, in a great way. And then came the third phase of COVID, which was when people were done with COVID, right? And lockdowns were removed. People were not as scared of COVID anymore. People were feeling better. The vaccines were rolled out. And that's when we it was almost, okay, COVID's now done. And a lot of people again told us, hey, do you think business will be impacted now that COVID's done? And, you know, I think we were very clear from day one of starting this business, which was way before COVID, right? That, look, people are going to move out of the cities as they get wealthier, right? Because they can, right? People don't live in Manhattan after a certain point. They move to Connecticut, right? And so on and so forth. And you can commute easily, right? As long as there's good infrastructure in the places that you live. And you want a better quality of life for your children. You want them to breathe cleaner air. You want them to go better schools and to better schools. And that's when we realized that, look, we think this opportunity is not for the next 4, 5, 6 years. We believe this opportunity is for the next 20 years in a place like India, right? People are getting rich very fast. They're aspirational. They want a better quality of life. Our cities are still, you know, unlike a London or a New York, right? We don't have, or we didn't have the infrastructure that a London or New York has, right? We're building it as we speak. We're building metros and we're building highways and we're building roads. And, you know, with that comes a whole lot of challenges, right? If you're living in that city while all of this is being built, there's a lot of pollution, there's a lot of noise. So we were really clear that people are going to move out of the cities, and COVID kind of gave us that window. And the third phase, which was the post-COVID phase, has been even stronger than the COVID phase, right? Because people have realized, hey, look, I can work from anywhere. My children deserve to breathe better air. I want more greenery. I want to be around nature. I don't want to be around concrete and steel all day. And hey, there are airports and there are highways, and you know, I can commute. So, you know, I think COVID really changed the mindset of people for good, forever. It wasn't a temporary shift. It's been a permanent shift in, hey, I want more space. I want more greenery. I want more nature. I want cleaner air. I want my own home. I don't want to be, you know, boxed inside an apartment again. And I think that it's been very pivotal for us.
All right. So now, in terms of capital raising too, how much capital have you guys raised to date?
So there are two levels of capital raising in our business. One is at the holdco, right, where the equity level in the company, and we've raised about $25 million to date. And then there are the SPV level raises, right, which kind of churn in and out as each project kind of completes. And there we've raised between $65 to $70 million to date. But of course, that keeps churning, right? So that number keeps growing as we grow. And it's a really efficient way to kind of raise capital because you're not giving away equity, right? At the SPV level, it's project funding. Without it being debt, we didn't want debt either. So we, you know, like I mentioned earlier, Alejandro, for us, it was super critical to be very capital efficient, right? We literally mortgaged the house, right? So there was no room to be too aggressive in the early days, and you know, we had to be very capital efficient, and we've maintained that discipline through the last decade.
So I guess in this case, I mean, the SPV, you know, obviously on the equity side, about 25 million on the SPV, about 70 million. What is that SPV strategy like? I mean, people would think that, you know, they would just like raise money, you know, in equity for their business. But in this case, you guys chose a different route, which was the SPV. So why the SPV route?
Two reasons. I think the first reason was when we started out and we were building, right? I don't think people had enough faith in the fact that an equity investment would make sense in a business like ours. They thought their capital would be locked in too long. They thought that there might or might not be an exit in a finite, you know, kind of period of time. It was almost compulsion for us, right, to set up this SPV structure where we were saying, what were we saying to people? Hey, look, we will do all the work around land and put it into an SPV. You come in and effectively fund that land, but this is not a debt structure. You are backed by, you're securitized by the underlying land, but this SPV will then do a JDA with Isprava and you'll get an equity style return. So while people were giving 12 to 14% returns on debt in India and the real estate space, I'm talking back then, now it's much higher, right? We were paying out 22% and 23% as an IRR in an equity structure, but not a fixed coupon debt. So it's not like we were liable to pay. This was only on sale. We'd do a revenue share. So we were paying out much higher IRRs in the early part of our journey, but we were a lot more protected, a lot more de-risked. And being a luxury brand, we were able to kind of drive margins higher that could kind of make up for some of that delta in financing cost in a way. But it's a very de-risk strategy and kind of protects us in the long term.
So obviously, you know, when it comes to investors, vision is a big one. So if you were to go to sleep tonight and you wake up in a world where the vision of Isprava is fully realized, what does that world look like?
You know, it's a loaded question, right? And if I woke up tomorrow and the world could be, you know, in line with the vision of Isprava, I think what it would be a very community-driven world where people, where like-minded people kind of come together to improve, substantially improve their quality of life for themselves and their family, right? I think that was our vision, right? Let's give people a better quality of life. And, you know, in the perfect world, I think that's what I would love to see, right? When we wake up in the morning, is see a world where, you know, people kind of collaborate, like-minded people, to improve the quality of lives for them and their families. I think very simply, that's the way I would see it. I'm not sure if I answered your question for, you know, the right way, but that would be my wish list.
So then as we're talking about the future here, I want to talk about the past, but doing so with a lens of reflection. So let's say I was to bring you back to 2013, you know, the time where you're thinking about starting something of your own. And let's say you were able to have a chat with your younger self. Mm-hmm. What would you tell that younger self? What would be that one piece of advice, you know, in terms of business before launching a business that you would give to your younger self, and why, given what you know now?
So, you know, if you don't mind, Alejandro, I'd actually give myself two pieces of advice. One would be, do not be in a hurry. Don't be in a rush. You know, I think there's so much rhetoric around being the first mover, being, hey, the market will go somewhere. It's a winner take all market, you know, and that's not the case. There's always a market and there's always room for everybody as long as you're doing it the right way. Right. So I think that's the first piece of advice I would give my younger self, which is don't be in a rush. Don't be in a hurry. Don't burn the candle too fast. It doesn't make sense. This is a marathon. This isn't a sprint. You know, really take your time to be thoughtful about how you're going to do it, and even balance your own personal life, just all aspects of your life. I think that would be the first piece of advice. Nothing's going anywhere. The second piece of advice would be that, you know, learn to drown out the noise and truly, truly believe in your own, you know, conviction. And you know, again, when you're starting out, I guess it's not just when you're starting out, at any stage of being an entrepreneur, I think it's really, really natural to keep doubting every step you take, right? Because you're kind of doing it alone, or you're doing it with a co-founder, right? And both of you are kind of, or three of you, as many co-founders as you are kind of doing it alone. And a lot rests on your shoulders, right? Your team, your investors, you know, there's just a lot of pressure. And what happens is you don't want to be in a case, you don't want to be in a situation, at least in your head, where you're saying, hey, somebody gave me that advice and I ignored it, and hey, look, they were right, right? But what happens is you start, I also think the flip side is, I also think one of the most important and underappreciated qualities you have to have as an entrepreneur is just insane clarity of thought, right? You have to be able to just drown out everything and get, you know, break complex problems down into literally, you know, bite-sized solutions and go at it that way. And what happens is when there's so much chatter, right, and you're doing something different or something new, people are going to kind of question it, and not they're not coming from a bad place. Many times they're coming from a good place, actually, right, to try and protect you, try and, you know, make you think differently. Look, I think listen to everybody's advice, but drown out the chatter. There's a lot of chatter, right? The truth is no one really knows. So I think just if you have strong conviction about something, really stick to it and do it the right way. It'll work. It's, you know, don't second guess yourself every day. It's not going to get you anywhere.
I love it. So, Iman, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
Email is the best. I'm pretty responsive over email. It's my first name, Dhiman, which is D for Dallas, H for Horse, I for India, M for Mumbai, A for Alabama, A for Alabama, N for Nebraska, at isprava.com. Isprava is I for India, S for sugar, B for pot, R for rain, A for Alabama, V for Virginia, A for Alabama.com. It's dhiman@isprava.com.
Easy enough. Well, Dhiman, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.